This is a special edition of On the Media featuring highlights from past shows. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the late morning of August 9, 1945, United States Air Force Major Charles Sweeney flew a B-29 bomber into the overcast sky above southern Japan. He climbed to an altitude of 28,900 feet and, during a break in the cloud cover, released his payload, a 10,000-pound atomic bomb codenamed Fat Man, which fell more than a minute before exploding over the port city of Nagasaki.
Atomic explosions as here at Nagasaki caused the prompt surrender of Japan and ushered in the atomic era, perhaps the greatest event of the greatest news year.
One of the era's main chroniclers of the Nagasaki bomb was William L. Lawrence. His 10-part series profiling the bomb would win him and the New York Times a Pulitzer Prize in 1946. Lawrence was never on the ground in Japan, but he had observed the bomb's manufacture and testing and had a bird's-eye view from his perch on a military plane when Fat Man fell on Nagasaki. It was clear that Lawrence benefited greatly from his access to the military. What wasn't known until after the bombs fell was that Lawrence was actually on the payroll of the U.S. War Department. David Goodman wrote about Lawrence in his book Exception to the Rulers, co-authored with his sister Amy. He says Lawrence was well situated to serve the Pentagon.
Lawrence was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. He was a science reporter for the Times. He won his first Pulitzer Prize in 1937. And he became a staunch advocate of the atomic bomb long before the atomic bomb was ever dropped. Throughout the 1930s, he was advocating for research into the use of atomic power, such that he earned a nickname, Atomic Bill.
So when the War Department was looking explicitly for a working newspaperman to help mold public opinion about the bomb, natural choice.
Indeed. General Leslie Groves was the military director of the Manhattan Project, scientists who researched and created the bomb. His own words were that he was looking for a, quote, suitable newspaperman to tell the story of the bomb to the public, to put the language of this arcane science into lay people's terms. So in March 1945, there was an extraordinary secret meeting held at the offices of the New York Times in which General Groves came to meet with William Lawrence and ask that he become a special consultant to the War Department.
David, there is one brief passage in a piece by Lawrence as he flew on the plane that was about to drop the bomb on Nagasaki that is an astonishing window into his frame of mind. Can you read that for me, please?
What Lawrence wrote was that he felt no, quote, pity or compassion for the poor devils who were about to die. And he went further because his compassion was reserved for the bomb itself. When the bomb detonated, quote, awestruck, we watched it shoot upward like a meteor coming from the earth instead of from outer space, becoming ever more alive as it climbed skyward through the white clouds. It was a living thing, a new species of being, born right before our incredulous eyes.
Now, the story goes beyond Lawrence reporting with an obvious conflict of interest about the dropping of the bomb. It gets far more sordid because when the news of radiation disease began to leak out, the War Department went into full defensive mode and used Lawrence to publish, in effect, disinformation. Tell me about that.
General Groves handpicked a group of journalists to accompany him not to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but to the bomb site out in New Mexico, where the first bomb was detonated. And it was there that William Lawrence wrote what General Groves had wanted him to write. Lawrence, quoting General Groves, writes, "The Japanese claim that people died from radiation. If this is true, the number was very small." Lawrence continues in his own editorializing in the story. He writes, quote, "The Japanese are still continuing their propaganda aimed at creating the impression that we won the war unfairly and thus attempting to create sympathy for themselves and milder terms. Thus, at the beginning, the Japanese described symptoms that did not ring true."
60 years later, the dropping of the bomb remains one of the great historical controversies. What I find so stunning about this is that at the contemporaneous moment when the world had to make up its mind, the New York Times, in effect, became a propaganda tool of the U.S. government. And for this, William L. Lawrence and the New York Times were awarded a Pulitzer Prize.
That's right. And the very debate that you allude to about was the atomic bomb an appropriate response? Well, Americans really wouldn't know if they don't know the reality of what happened on the ground. In our book, we call for William Lawrence's Pulitzer Prize to be stripped. I think that this story has some very important modern parallels, certainly in the case of the Iraq War and in the case of the New York Times with the, I would say, credulous, uncritical reporting of Judith Miller, among others. Anytime we see the drums of war, we should really be looking to journalists to challenge those in power, not to become a megaphone for those in power.
Well, David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
David Goodman is co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.